Happy Monday, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Peter Suderman, sitting in for Matt Welch, who is exploring the wilds of a free, vaccinated, and car-owning America. Today, I am joined by my colleagues Catherine Mengu Ward, Nick Gillespie, and special guest, Reason Senior Editor Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Everybody say hi.
Howdy.
Hi.
Hey, Peter.
All right, so on this week's podcast, we are going to talk about Washington's big war on big tech. But first, a word about Bound by Oath, a new documentary podcast from the Institute for Justice. The new season explores why it's so hard to sue government officials when they violate the Constitution. Even when you are clearly injured, it can be nearly impossible to obtain justice because of a mountain of immunities that the courts have cast in the way. Bound by Oath explores these issues through real stories of real people fighting to vindicate their rights, as well as through interviews with the nation's foremost scholars and lawyers. Bound by Oath is available on any podcast app. Okay, so at this point, we all know Joe Biden is a big spender, but he is also a big government guy generally, which means he's also a big regulator. And nowhere is the new drive toward regulation more visible than the push to regulate big tech. But just because it's visible doesn't mean that it's necessarily clear what exactly is happening. Democrats are pretty sure they want to regulate big tech somehow, but they aren't quite sure what they want to do or why. You know the Aristotelian term telos, right? The fundamental purpose of a being or an object? Well, the Democratic fight to regulate big tech lacks telos. It's a soul without a body, or maybe a body without a soul. Either way, it's a lot like that little Tina Fey pre-person character from Pixar's Soul. It just hasn't figured itself out yet, or what it wants to be in the world. And of course, there's a bipartisan complication here, which is that Republicans also seem quite determined to regulate big tech, too. And to the extent that Republicans have clear ideas about how to wrangle Facebook and Google and the rest, they are in tension in many ways with Democratic demands. That confusion and tension was on display last week in yet another big tech hearing before the House. Kind of seems like a Disney Plus show at this point, right? The House is just rolling out a big tech hearing every single week, and you got to tune in to find out what's going on. So this time, the CEOs of Facebook, Twitter, and Google showed up virtually once again to face questions about, like, just an incredible amount of things. I just want to read a little bit from the Washington Post's summary of the hearing. During the more than 5-hour hearing, lawmakers in 5-minute intervals called out executives on a wide range of issues, including extremism, misinformation, cyberbullying, climate change, and the coronavirus. There were also questions about Section 230, who's responsible for the Capitol riot, the Netflix movie The Social Dilemma, social media addiction amongst children. Sadly, there was no mention of mixed metaphors or loud sighing noises on podcasts, which, for my money, are the actual biggest tech problems of our age. I'm sure we'll get there. Elizabeth Nolan Brown, you have been covering this stuff for a while now, and I know you paid attention to the hearing, so help us understand what is happening here. What is it that Democrats want? What do Republicans want? How do we understand the relationship between the two? Because as far as I can tell, the answer just sort of seems to be both parties want to blame big tech for absolutely everything.
Yeah, I think that's one pretty fair takeaway from all of this. A lot of these things, you know, you have them grilling the tech CEOs and asking for yes or no answers to really complex questions because they all just sort of want to get good clips for their PR and their fundraising instead of actually, you know, having a discussion about what are really, you know, serious and complex issues. To some degree, Democrats and Republicans want diametrically opposed things from, you know, from tech reform or from Section 230 reform. You hear a lot about how Democrats definitely just want to be able to crack down on more sort of speech. There's no question about that. People will say that Republicans want to have tech companies crack down on less speech, which is sometimes true. They want them to be able to sort of, you know, get rid of less people that they deem on their side. But it's not, I think that kind of makes them seem too positive because there are also many kinds of speech that Republicans are talking about in these hearings and in the laws that they introduce getting rid of also. So it's really...
Can you give an example?
Well, like a lot of, you know, they say that they're concerned with things like sexual exploitation and things like that, but which usually just means any sort of sexual content online. So you kind of, you know, have them or terrorist content. I mean, right now they're against it because they're saying, you know, it's, oh, we're talking about domestic terrorism in the Capitol riots. So they're kind of not doing that right at this moment. But other times you'll have them talk about how we need to crack down on, you know, extremists online when they think that those extremists were Antifa or whatever. So really, Democrats pretty much universally want to crack down on more speech. Republicans want to selectively crack down on more speech. It kind of comes down to, I think both sides are unwilling to accept the fact that content moderation online will never be perfect when you're talking about the massive volume of things that people are posting to the internet every day across all of these platforms. And they just really seem unwilling to accept that tech companies are never going to be able to get it right. Even if we could agree on what the standard should be, it would never be possible to actually do that. I think that the other biggest takeaway from all of this is that in so many of these cases, so many of these hearings, people aren't actually mad at Section 230 there, which is, you know, the law that we hear a ton about. Trump was really, really on about it, but, you know, Democrats have also been on about it too and introduced so far this year, 7 different bills to limit or abolish Section 230. And so, you know, people are kind of scapegoating this because it's not actually that complicated, but you know, they've made it to be very complicated. So it's easy to say like, oh, this obscure law, like that's to blame for all of our problems with the internet. But really, they're just mad at the First Amendment. To a good quote, I think, from Jess Mears, who is a law student and also a writer, and she was writing at TechDirt, like, contrary to what seems to be a popular belief, Section 230 isn't what's stopping the government from pulling the plug on Twitter for taking down the New York Post tweets or exposing bloviating lying elected officials. Indeed, without Section 230, plaintiffs with a big tech axe to grind will still have a significant hurdle to overcome, the First Amendment. And the thing is, that is very true. Like, a lot of the speech is protected by the First Amendment. Section 230 just makes it easier to not have these cases go into court and have to fight harder for the First Amendment. So without Section 230, you'd have tech companies having to go and just defend their First Amendment rights a lot harder, and it'd be a lot more time consuming and a lot more expensive, which means that, you know, companies like Facebook would actually be okay. It might be a little bit of a burden, but they would still be okay. Whereas their smaller companies and competitors and independent companies would be the ones who would be really screwed. And that's why you see Facebook starting to come around and say like, oh, maybe we should abolish Section 230, because they know that that'll get them good favor from the government. And they're not the ones who are actually going to be harmed by it. It's not the big tech companies. It's sort of the rest of the internet.
You're not mad about Section 230. You're mad about the First Amendment is a really good slogan. And I just think someone should put that on a T-shirt. Oh, wait, you already did.
Yeah, I did. I'm a big dork.
Yeah. So, Nick, I want to ask you about this. So much of this on both sides of the aisle is about speech. Almost all of the talk, as Elizabeth mentioned, about Section 230, which in a nutshell just sort of says tech companies don't have legal liability for content posted by others, is about what sort of speech will be allowed online. Democrats, broadly speaking, want tighter controls on so-called misinformation. Republicans are much more focused on restricting social media companies from blocking conservative speech. But I also think there's something else going on here. I think that there's just something here. There is a dispute about power and the fact that tech in its current incarnation is a rival power center to Washington, D.C., to the federal government, to Congress, and that big tech is in some sense creating a society, a form of human interaction that is outside the reach of our political class, or at least more outside the reach than a lot of other things. And that, in fact, allows the political class to be targeted for mockery and criticism. So just for example, here is an Elizabeth Warren tweet from last week that I thought was so telling.
Ooh-wee.
So I'm just going to read this. I didn't write the loopholes you exploit at Amazon. She's tweeting at the Amazon corporate account. Your armies of lawyers and lobbyists did. But you bet I'll fight to make you pay your fair share and fight your union busting and fight to break up big tech so you're not powerful enough to heckle senators with snotty tweets. That's what's driving Elizabeth Warren and her push to use federal antitrust power to break up a bazillion-dollar company that provides huge value to tens of millions of Americans. She's mad about the snotty tweets. So my question is, Nick, how much of this do you think is about the nitty-gritty particulars of online speech rules? And how much is just the fact that tech companies allow people to interact and do stuff and have a life without a government hall monitor? And that makes the hall monitors mad.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge part of it. And I look forward to the glorious day probably in the next week, maybe 14 days, when Elizabeth Warren starts getting into a Twitter feud with the Steak-ums corporate account.
This definitely ends with a, like, sir, this is a Wendy's situation.
This is a big part of it, that the political class, and it's important because this also in many ways includes certain types of legacy media institutions such as the New York Times. But there's no question that so many different ways of talking beyond the reach of other people, you know, that pisses off Washington. I think it pisses off journalists who are, you know, talking about policing places like Clubhouse, which is the newest kind of temporary autonomous zone that has opened up in cyberspace. I think there's another thing, though, too, which is also a big chunk of it, is that there's a widespread belief that, you know, big tech has not delivered the utopia you want. And I think in terms of both, Peter, what you were saying, but also picking up on what Liz was saying, is that, you know, this, we have all of these new places to talk and all of these new ways to interact, and it really isn't that satisfying. We are living in a kind of real life instantiation of the Venture Brothers, the Adult Swim series that was about how super science,
which was very satisfying.
It was great, but it was all about how super science, a kind of you know, new frontier, 60s John F. Kennedy, Final Frontier, Star Trek type of world, like, had in many ways delivered on all of the stuff it was supposed to give us, but we're not happier. And I think that's a big part of it, because we are actually able to have many more conversations than we used to. And that what that creates then is simultaneously both more speech and various forms of cancel culture, you know, from what's going on in Washington to people, you know, who are seizing cultural power, you know, in the name of minority representation. I was just, you know, the guy who is the author of the Captain Underpants series, which if you have kids in the last 25 years, you've suffered through these.
This is going to be my, what am I consuming? So
I won't go into details other than
we can
Dave,
talk about it later.
Yeah. Dave Pilkey, the author of that, and Scholastic Books, his publishers, have pulled a title and have done a ritual apology because, you know, they've offended people. This is the new frontier. This is the world we live in, and it's not particularly satisfying. But I think the positive thing to think about is that we, you know, more arguments are coming up to the surface, and that's the good thing. And it's disturbing to see both Republicans and Democrats trying in their own ways to kind of crush this, because this is the beginning of consensus. And the consensus will be to throw some kind of blanket of regulation on it. It won't be particularly successful. It won't solve anything. And it will squelch certain types of speech. But it's also in its own way a sign that we do have robust speech.
I like this theory, right? Like you're basically saying that we're blaming, in addition to everything else, we're blaming big tech for our existential malaise, right? For our postmodern ennui.
Yeah,
and you know,
we don't have good stories to tell ourselves about who we are, either as individuals or groups, and so we're blaming, you know, we're blaming the capitalist that sold us the rope to
I'm
hang
sad.
Ourselves.
And therefore, eliminate Section 230.
Yeah, if I may also, just on the hearings, I think the most interesting takeaway for me was when Jack Dorsey said Twitter made a mistake by censoring the New York Post story about Biden's
Dorsey
laptop.
Dorsey is a weird and interesting figure, and his journey from, like, from meditating tech bro to Harry Potter villain wizard, right, has been both visually and philosophically actually kind of interesting.
Also, by the way, and just to throw big tech into the problem here too, is that, you know, most of these platforms, certainly Twitter and Facebook, in North America and in Western Europe, in the developed world, but especially North America, they've seen either flat or a declining rate of increase in users and daily use. Post-Trump, this is happening again throughout all media, and that's undergirding a lot of the anxiety all the way around. Because not only, you know, is it harder to control what people are saying, but fewer people are kind of saying it, or, you know, everywhere around, like, the system is consolidating, you know, on some level. And it's like watching a, you know, it's like watching an industry that's 30 or 40 years old, maybe, or maybe younger in the name of social media per se, but it has now reached a certain level of maturity. And what we're witnessing in real time is the way that that consolidation kind of and government kind of come together, sometimes in good ways, mostly in bad ways. But that's also a big function.
Just to add to that, like, I think it's so terrible because so many of the laws that we're or things that the government is doing right now are to go after these companies, which are by a lot of accounts maybe on the decline. You know, they're going to end up hurting all the smaller companies, but based on this idea that they're attacking companies which are already on their way to not being dominant.
Yeah, the entire antitrust push is predicated on the idea that these companies are so big and so dominant that without government regulation, they will always have this place of power in our society, and yet they're already losing it. Catherine, I want to go to you here, and I actually want to talk about big social media companies that might be afraid of losing their power and what they are doing about it. So at this point, it's not just Congress that wants regulation, right? Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg showed up with a proposal to require large tech companies to have systems, I guess regulated systems in place for removing unlawful content. And this would be a reform to Section 230. So if you listen to political podcasts these days, not this one, but they're absolutely up to their eyeballs and happy little ads in which some inoffensive and disembodied voice from Facebook says, "Hey, we think the internet needs to be regulated too, and let us help." And it almost makes me miss the days of riding the DC Metro and seeing ads that were just like a photo of a stealth bomber against a beautiful sunset and the word Boeing. And you're like, I guess I'm supposed to vote for Boeing to have more billions of dollars. But there was a great story from NBC News about Zuckerberg's content removal proposal. And it had this like delightful little thinking face emoji subhead. While meant to ensure that companies are taking action against unlawful content, the changes could theoretically shore up Facebook's power.
Golly gee willikers.
So, Catherine, what do you think here? Are these just are these the Boeing ads of 2021?
Yes.
Is Facebook the stealth bomber of our of today?
I hope that someday kids will hold bake sales to buy their Facebook accounts or something. I think that that's right. And I because of my deep objectivist roots, always want for there to be entrepreneur heroes in stories. And it's a weakness of mine, because it turns out that the far more common narrative is not the heroic standalone entrepreneur hero guy who stays that way. It's the Mark Zuckerberg story. It's the company that becomes dominant in the marketplace and then seeks to lock in its dominance via regulation or erecting barriers to entry. And this is an old story. Nobody who thinks about government or markets should be surprised that this is the past that we have come to. In some ways, it's more surprising that we get players like Dorsey to some extent, but others as well who are not taking that road. They, you know, Dorsey could easily at this point be on Team Zuckerberg and get protections for himself too, and he kind of isn't in a way that's fascinating. So I guess
and he's very clearly implying in his statements that he sees Facebook's proposal as a direct attack on Twitter.
That's right. At the same time, I remain, even in the face of Zuckerbergian perfidy, I remain optimistic because, as we've talked about on this podcast before, there are so many other platforms and competitors springing up all the time. And I cannot understand why people want so badly to treat these social media companies as if there are no competitors, as if they are a government monopoly, public square type scenario. Now, it is true that there are places where private companies do have all the benefit of regulation and function in ways that are really, really problematic because they are dominant in a market that should be competitive. I'm thinking here of, you know, cable providers, utilities, that kind of thing, which makes it all the more ridiculous that there is this huge push among the antitrust intelligentsia to treat Facebook like a public utility. That's one thing we keep hearing. As if people love the way their public utilities work. As if that's a really incredible model that everybody is like, yeah, we got this one.
Facebook and the sewer system, right?
Sure. I think that the story of Zuckerberg begging to be regulated is in some ways the most sort of disappointing story to me. I expect public servants to, protect their own turf and to try and grow their power. And I expect companies to try and grow their market share. But when those two things overlap, as they so often do, we get a real worst case scenario. And it sucks to watch it happening in real time, live on TV, because once a month, congressmen want a grandstand about it.
Wait, so you're saying that Nick is right and big tech is causing you existential despair?
A little bit, but
talk about it on social media.
Yeah, I'm going to get on Twitter and complain about...
Create a new emoji.
I will say my real fave is when politicians get on one platform and complain about the overwhelming monopoly power of another platform. And that happens...
Yeah, Josh Hawley has done
all
this
the time.
Every day.
Number of times.
Every day we have somebody... I mean, that Elizabeth Warren tweet you read is even in some way, Amazon owning the internet, being too powerful, she said on another part of the internet. Like, stop it. The internet is huge. It contains many voices. There are many places to go if you don't like the particular platform that's in trouble at the moment. Stop pretending like you have no choices.
Also, the idea that if you broke up Amazon, suddenly it would not be powerful enough to tweet. I mean, like, literally anyone with fingers and consciousness is powerful.
You don't even need fingers. Yes. Voice to text, my guy. Like,
yeah. The solutions here do not match the theory of the case at all. And Liz, so since we've got you here, I want to ask you about some of the other proposed solutions. A couple of Democrats had additional Section 230 reforms. Anna Eshoo of California, for example, had the Protecting Americans from Dangerous Algorithms Act, those terrifying algorithms that would amend Section 230 to remove tech companies' protections.
The only good algorithm is a dead algorithm.
I think that's actually Elon Musk's theory.
But
this would remove tech companies' protections from lawsuits when their algorithms amplify content that lead to offline violence. I guess that means it's fine if they lead to mean tweets. And then there was a Representative Clark from New York had a separate bill intended to prevent discrimination in online advertising. So you have written a lot about Section 230. In general, I think it's fair to characterize you as a defender of the current Section 230 regime. You've helped, I think, many people understand that a lot of the discourse around Section 230 is predicated on fundamental misunderstandings of what that law does. So just give us the short version here. What is Section 230? Why does it matter? And why shouldn't we be worried about dangerous algorithms or discrimination?
You explained earlier that, Section 230 gives tech companies and their users, which is a part people always forget, but also and the users protection from being held as the speakers of each other's content. So basically, like, you are not Twitter, Twitter is not you. There are lots of exceptions to this.
I don't know about that. There's some days I really feel like there's not much of a distinction.
But yeah, it says that you're not automatically treated as the speaker of content that someone else posts.
In a court
yes,
of law,
in a court of law, you are not Twitter. I think the two biggest misconceptions we hear about this are the idea that it requires some sort of neutrality. That's a big one that Republicans have been spreading, which is just not the case. I mean, in fact, one of the problems was that people were worried that if they were in the early days back in the 90s, that if they were moderating content at all, then they would be more, seen as being more aware of content and then therefore they would be more liable for it. So people just weren't really moderating content. And they were like, legislators were like, we don't want people to not be moderating any content for fear that that'll increase their liability. So part of the reason Section 230 was passed was to give people the right to discriminate against content that was illegal or just as otherwise offensive. So, the idea that this required some sort of viewpoint neutrality is just completely false. And that's what we would want, because without that, you know, you couldn't have any sort of forums that set their own rules. You couldn't have a forum, you know, always to go at conservatives who act like that's desirable. You couldn't have a forum that was devoted only to conservative thought. Like, it could just be overrun by liberals and they would have no power to kick them out. You couldn't have a forum that was related to, you know, devoted to Christian talk without, you know, people that were atheists or whatever, Satanists or whatever, coming in and just, you know, yeah, exactly, with his blood shoes.
Little Nas X dances to coming in there with his blood sneakers.
The devil is in the details.
Yes. So that's the big one. And then, you know, people also seem to think that this means that there's no way to hold tech companies accountable for any illegal action, which is also not true. It doesn't apply when federal crimes are concerned. And also, it doesn't apply to anything that tech companies themselves create. So if, you know, Twitter or just, you know, like a more obscure company, because it's hard to see Twitter doing this, but like, you know, if they actually create content that is illegal in and of themselves, like libelous content or content that, you know, is against like laws regarding sexual exploitation or anything like that, they would be held liable for it. It's not that you can't be held that just because you're a tech company, you're suddenly like immune to all laws. It's just that you are not automatically held liable for everything that anyone posts. And if you find out that you do have certain knowledge of it and did, you know, certain things with creating it, then you can be.
So this is very helpful. And I think it kind of clarifies, you know, just some of the issues here, which is, that what people in Congress seem to want is a world in which online speech is checked in some sense by Congress, except that Congress doesn't even want to do the job themselves. They both want to be in charge of it and not have to do it, right? And so what they want to do is write laws that force tech companies to do the thing that they would have done if they had the time, inclination, et cetera, to do it all, right?
If they were even possible.
Like if they were the ones who are actually sort of managing. And it's not possible, right? And the only way you can do it in some ways is through algorithms, which kind of handle these things automatically. But as we know, the algorithms are dangerous. So I want to move on here.
You know,
Nick, do you have one more thing you want to say?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, Peter, this, I think, two things to focus on, especially from a libertarian angle. One is that, you know, what the government is trying to do here is awful and terrible because they want to control speech, but they don't know exactly how to do that. They just want to control speech that bothers them. And that's, you know, really something we need to push back at. On the other side, you know, a lot of these companies, I think, have abetted, you know, that mindset because they like to believe that they are really powerful and influential and that they are the drivers of everything good and hence bad. And this is where Jack Dorsey's other statement that I think is problematic is that he also said that, you know, he was the only one of the big tech CEOs who admitted that or confessed that, you know, that his platform was actually partly responsible for those terrible events of January 6th, which, you know, was like the end of America and things like that. And I think, you know, tech companies, the minute that they start to actually, you know, kind of, you know, get high on their own supply of megalomania, they're asking for this. And one of the things I think that is useful to do is to like point out that, you know, Twitter and Facebook, YouTube, they're great, they're interesting, and they are not fundamentally the reason why Americans have elections where they're really close and people are polarized. You know, it's not Twitter's fault. And as a result, they're not responsible for it. And we need to have a different paradigm when we're talking about media and what it enables and how it actually affects and changes society or not.
Well, since you mention elections and voting, we are going to move on to voting and voting laws. But before that, on October 2nd, 2018, respected Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. He was never seen alive again. At a time when America is focused on its own domestic crises, there's one movie that reminds us there are unbelievable and shocking events unfolding on a global scale. The new documentary, The Dissident, boldly looks into the events and intrigue surrounding the murder that shocked the world. Senator Lindsey Graham says, there's not a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw. The movie not only unearths new proof, it ultimately exposes Khashoggi's killers. Senator Rand Paul states, the evidence is overwhelming that the Crown Prince was involved. playing out at the highest levels of power and wealth, the Associated Press calls The Dissident a real-life thriller. Are you ready for the truth? From the Academy Award-winning director of Icarus, The Dissident, rated PG-13. Now playing at home and on demand. Visit thedissident.com for more information. That's thedissident.com. All right, so on Friday, Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp signed a new law aimed at, depending on who you ask, either bolstering election integrity or at significantly reducing the number of people who vote in the state of Georgia in an effort to give Republicans an electoral advantage. The law implements tighter ID requirements, limits on the number of ballot drop boxes allowed in any given county, additional state control of county voting boards, and most controversially, at least on Twitter, some limits on how water can be delivered and distributed to voters standing in line to vote. This is the first of what we can expect will be many such bills. Republicans are pushing similar changes in, by at least one count, 43 states. And Democrats in Congress are pushing back with a slate of reforms that they are describing as democracy reforms, including the For the People Act, which is now circulating in the Senate. President Biden called the Georgia law an atrocity, said it was Jim Crow in the 21st century. He also said we have a moral and constitutional obligation to act. So, Catherine, I want to go to you here. Help us make some basic sense of this. What does this law actually do and why? And why all the fuss over what Republicans claim are just laws designed to improve election integrity and trust in the system?
So I'll start by just recommending we have a quite impressive treatment of this question on our site this morning, The Republican Attack on Voting Rights by Matthew Harwood. He's written for us for a few years now. He used to be at the ACLU. He's now at the Brennan Center. And he just really lays out what exactly is going on. The piece starts with a finger wagging James Madison and ends with a rousing Frederick Douglass. And in between, there's a bunch of Republicans trying to restrict voting. So let's talk about it. Basically, the thing that I have struggled with on this issue is I like to give people the benefit of the doubt. I like to assume that people are acting in basically good faith, including Republican state legislators, as difficult as that may sometimes be. And so what I would like to assume is that they are simply trying to win elections. They are trying to figure out how to get as many Republicans as possible to vote and to stop Democrats from voting in whatever way they can within the bounds of the law. And it just so happens, for important historical reasons, that in this country, a good way to suppress the Democratic vote is to suppress the Black vote. That this is not individual personal racism, but instead just the same as gerrymandering and a bunch of other types of gambits which the parties do to try and win. That's the story.
So you're saying the best case is that it's unintentional racism?
Correct. But I think that that's actually worth taking a minute and talking about, because I think that there are lots and lots of people in the discourse around this right now who have jumped straight to every single Republican legislator in Georgia and Texas and Arizona and all these other states is personally racist. And I just find that actually quite difficult to believe. However, I think in the end, that question doesn't matter that much in terms of whether you should support these laws. They are still very bad policy. It is still ultimately, the outcome of dramatically reducing access to the polls for Black people in a whole bunch of states is a problem. It is a major violation of what I think should be the ethos of our voting laws generally, which is to maximize accessibility for the polls for all people and, a right with a bunch of barriers thrown up in front of it is a right denied. I think that's pretty clear. But then the other question is, okay, so there's all these states. States are in charge of elections. There's all these states that are passing these new laws or trying to and will be successful in places where Republicans are dominant. What do we do? And one answer to that question is the federal government has the power to jump in and interfere, if they think that state legislators are restricting rights beyond what is acceptable in federal elections. But I don't like it, when the federal government interferes with states. I think in general that goes badly. And so I want to be extremely cautious about calling on the federal government to step in and tell states what to do, how to run their elections. So for me, it's a little bit of a sticky wicket. And I think, you know, ideally the answer is some combination of, you know, the democratic process in those states, in individual states. I hope that people see this as an outrageous act and vote out the people who did it. That's a long-term strategy. In the meantime, I do think the threat of federal action can hopefully exert a certain amount of kind of chilling pressure on some of the more extreme Republican efforts. But it's a bad situation. And it's clearly all, to my mind, in the end, going to further polarize elections and make people have less trust in them, which is an extremely bad outcome, even for someone, as you know, who does not enjoy participating in elections. I would still like people to generally believe that their outcomes are just and accurate because they are.
Nick, in some ways, this strikes me as a really telling kind of moment for the Republican Party in particular. So I actually just want to set aside the racial implications as important as they are, but let's just table them just for a moment here. Republicans are pushing these voting rule changes, which are happening in 43 states, so most of the country. And they're not fighting about policy outcomes. This is just about voting rules and about changing voting rules in a way to preserve and extend their own political power. And it's coming at a time when Republicans seem to be kind of lost. They're casting about for an agenda that goes beyond supporting Donald Trump. Like, if you remember, in the run-up to the 2020 election, the Republican Party didn't run on a platform at all. They just sort of said, we're going to have the 2016 one again, and we support Trump's agenda, whatever that happens to be. And so what it sort of seems to me is that the Republican Party has given up on persuading people. They're not out there saying, we want to win elections by making a case that our policies, whatever they happen to be, will lead to a better country and a better life for you and your family. They're out there saying, we need to restructure voting laws to ensure that we win regardless of what our policies are. Am I misunderstanding this? Is this a signal that the Republican Party has, in some sense, just given up on efforts to persuade people to join the Republican coalition? And if so, what do we make of that?
I think that you're mistaken.
Okay.
I think that that's an overly broad conclusion to draw from a longstanding Republican kind of commitment to having much more formalized election rules and things like that. And I think one of the problems in our political discourse is that we're constantly pronouncing with every election and sometimes even after midterms that some kind of corner has been turned and some kind of dramatic shift in, you know, direction or anything. The fact of the matter is perhaps the Republicans didn't run on a coherent platform, but they actually did pretty well nationally, and they did very well at the state level. Whatever they were running on, they were pretty successful. Trump even, you know, got more votes than he, you know, than any other Republican candidate ever, successful or not. So, you know, there is a platform that the Republicans kind of stand for. I think it's telling that, you know, they are stupid enough that they don't understand that, you know, a big turnout doesn't necessarily hurt them. This is one of the things that political science scientist Maurice Fiorina constantly comes back to, is the whole idea that large voter turnouts favor Democrats is an old conventional wisdom that does not actually map very well onto the last 20 years or so. Political scientists know this, pollsters don't, pundits don't, and it's strange. So, you know, that's one point. The other point is also that for all of the discussion about attempts to kind of lock down voter registration and voter access and things like that, when you look at presidential elections over the past 20 years, 2000, there's a way of various ways of calculating turnout. There's a percentage of voting age population, and then there's also one that's a little bit more defined, a voter eligible population. And in both of those, particularly actually in the voter eligible populations, you know, we're voting more since 2000, and it kind of chunked up after a certain level. In 2020, it looks like about 67% of the voting eligible population, so that's people of voting age who actually are not kicked off the rolls for some reason, showed up. That's actually pretty promising. I don't understand why the Republicans, are acting this way, because they actually do pretty well when lots of people come out. So it's bad on them for that. But I don't necessarily see it as a sign that they are brain dead in any particular kind of policy play.
Yeah, I think this is a good point. You know, despite not taking control of the House, the Senate, or the White House, Republicans in some ways did do quite well with a very large turnout in the 2020 election. And they didn't just do better with core Republican voters. They improved their standing with minorities, in particular Latinos. And if you sort of take them at their word that they want to shift the party towards being a working class party, which you can define as being a less educated, right, or having fewer college educated voters in their coalition, those folks are lower propensity voters historically, which means that higher turnout should, at least for a working class coalition, actually be better for Republicans. And so if the goal of a Georgia type voting law is to keep voting, you know, total voting lower, right, then they could actually be shooting themselves in the foot, at least in the medium to long term here. Liz, I want to ask you about this, just sort of a different question. We've talked about big tech already here, and both of you have written about how the war on big tech has been consumed by, or maybe has consumed, I don't know, it's sort of an Earl Burroughs situation, but how it's sort of just all been folded into the culture war. And this sort of seems like the same thing to me. This is, on the one hand, a package of real and meaningful voting changes that will have substantial impacts on voting and voting outcomes. But it's also just a kind of a rallying cry for the Republican Party in some ways, a way of defining themselves against the Democratic bad guys and Democratic perfidy and all, whatever. And you know, I guess my question here is, why has the culture war eaten all of American politics? And what can we as exasperated...
A small question, yes, for you.
But what can we as exasperated and peace-loving normal people who don't want any part of any war, cultural or otherwise, do about it?
I have no idea how to answer that first question. So I will just say that I was going to comment before you even asked this question about the Georgia voting law thing that, I mean, exactly what you said, pretty much, that this has effects beyond what the law actually does. Like whether or not these, you know, have the intended effect with regards to suppressing voter turnout or suppressing certain sorts of voter turnout, whether or not they even pass, the point sort of is just the process, I think, because it's twofold. It lets Republicans play up the Trumpian element, the idea that voter fraud was widespread in the 2020 election and that they need to do something about that. And also just the politics of grievance, which I think really comes into play with the big tech stuff. I mean, the idea that someone somewhere is cheating and being unfair to people like you is what so much across the spectrum of Republican policy is based on these days. So I think, you know, maybe that's part of the answer of why the culture war has gotten so bad, because the idea that like someone somewhere is being unfair to conservatives is sort of underlies, it seems like, almost everything that conservative politicians are doing these days.
All right. So speaking of opting out, I just want to do a quick round the round table question here. I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this, but is there anybody on this podcast who has not used marijuana recreationally? Anybody? No? No takers? Okay. I guess we've all enjoyed at least a little bit.
I've used right. it professionally.
For business purposes as well.
So speaking of using it for businesses purposes, we have all enjoyed it maybe a little more than a little bit at times. And guess what? Probably none of us are getting jobs in the Biden White House. So one of the things that happened here.
That's the problem.
Yes. One of the things that happens here in Washington is that people get hired to senior government jobs, and then the background checks start after they start working in those jobs. So under Biden, those checks are proceeding and they're discovering that people in Democratic politics who are under 40 years old have used marijuana. And in some cases, those people are losing their jobs. Five people are no longer employed at the White House after background checks found histories of drug use. And several more are apparently just they're working remotely as a punishment, which I don't understand at all.
To keep the drugs away from the other staffers.
But it seems like the opposite of a punishment. You don't have to wear a suit. You get to stay home, get high, play Tetris. It seems great. Nick, I actually want to ask you here just real quickly. Who the hell cares? And I mean that in two ways. Like, who in the world in the year of our Lord 2021, who cares about these folks using pot in their in their own time? It's legal in Washington, D.C., but also this is the federal government. They're the federal government is going to implement employment rules and requirements. They're probably going to be dumb. Is that something we should care about at all?
Well, the short answer to your question is that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris care. And in 2019, over 500,000 people were arrested for marijuana-related offenses. Many, if not most of those, were simple possession. So, there's a lot of people in America who care about this, and certainly Joe Biden does. I struggle not to try and make like a joke about all of this, because in the end, you know, any of the people who got bounced from the White House, and there's the five people, and then, you know, the news accounts all say dozens of others who were either put on some kind of hold or encouraged to leave employment and things like that. Those people are going to be fine. But there is, you know, we're at the beginning stages of the end of the drug war. And it's not funny anymore. You know, that people are still taking it on the chin for things like having used marijuana at any level. And it shows that somebody like Joe Biden is not he's certainly not a libertarian. He's not a libertarian when it comes to criminal justice. He's not when it comes to the drug war. He's not when it comes to foreign policy. Not when it comes to spending, regulation, and everything else. But it also shows that the people who mistook somebody like Barack Obama or Joe Biden or Kamala Harris for, you know, being okay on drugs because I like a bunch of other crap that they do, you know, it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, Biden's.
And it's
Biden
something.
Has actually, this has been one of the places where he has struggled to come to the center of the Democratic Party, even though he has in many ways found the Democratic center and been very, very effective at that over the years of sort of always being right in the middle of not of American politics, but of where Democratic politics is at any given moment. This is one of the places where he has not come along.
Yeah. And, you know, I always think of this when I hear stories like this, and there are worse cases of this where, you know, where there are still people in jail for selling marijuana or using marijuana in states where it's been made legal. You know, it's like the soldier at the end of All Quiet on the Western Front, you know, who dies after the armistice has been signed. And this is the type of story, rather than kind of provoking a chuckle in people, it should be the type of thing that lights a fire to really unwind the drug war as quickly as possible, because there is widespread public opinion. Everybody knows this is bad policy. And now can we rush to get to the finish line of unwinding all of the various policies, which are going to be much harder to do than we think, you know, because it affects every atom of, you know, of American life, culture, and politics.
With that, we will rush to the finish line of this podcast with our listener question. Today's listener question is from Andrew G. I'm going to slightly edit and rearrange it, as is my moderator's prerogative. He writes, "Dear Reason Roundtable, I have so much praise and admiration for each and every one of you." And then he goes on to praise each and every one of us. Andrew G., this is how you get your question read on the podcast. He says, "Peter, thank you for your fantastic drink recommendations, as well as your music suggestions. You're welcome. Thank you to Nick for calling it like it is, and great job on Bill Maher. Thank you to Catherine Mangu Ward, not only for pro-rocket recommendations, but for the excitement Andrew G. gets when he sees that glossy new Reason magazine sitting in the mailbox. And thank you to Matt for something, something Billy Joel baseball and something about bands from the 70s. I'm sure he's a huge fan of Elizabeth Nolan Brown, too. So his question, which he says is quick and easy, I'm going to throw to Catherine and Elizabeth, and you guys can figure out what you think here. Is catcalling freedom of speech, and is it violence? Liz?
I'm just going to go with a yes, it is freedom of speech, and no, it is not violence.
In some ways, that is all you need to say, but I will slightly expand on it and just say, you know, there's all kinds of speech out there that is protected, yet offensive. And there are only two reasons why you would specially ban catcalling. One is because you think we should have special rules for ladies, because ladies can't handle the offensive speech or something. It makes them sad and upset, and ladies are vulnerable and need extra protection. So I think I speak for at least me and Liz, if not many other ladies, when I say fuck that. And if we think that somehow speech that is sex-oriented or sex-adjacent needs to have special rules around it, then I hate to break it to you, but like catcalls are the least of our problem. Arguably, literally all of human speech is sex-adjacent if you talk to the right evolutionary psychologist, but at the very least, there are many, many, many places on the internet where people are fundamentally talking about sex, sometimes in offensive ways, and I do not think we want to get in the business of regulating all of that. So, yeah. Catcalling is fun.
Also, I think any way that you would have to enforce that would just end up being ridiculously biased too.
Yeah. No, I look forward to
aside from
if we actually put in anti-catcalling laws, like I look forward to the absolutely offensive and horrific demographic statistics around arrests having to do with it. It would be a nightmare.
It does seem like the general cultural campaign against catcalling has been largely effective. I don't know, Liz and Catherine, if your experience, has changed over the past couple of years.
Nick, I can't
decades.
Tell my guy because I got old. Either society is more enlightened or I'm less catcallable and I haven't left the house in a year.
Look forward to catcalls, virtual catcalls.
I can't
Peter,
tell.
Have you ever catcalled?
I have called actual kittens into my house when they have refused to come in for dinner.
You're just inviting in
my family
cats.
Had cats when I was I that's
so they'll take that as a yes then.
I will say, here's my one catcalling tidbit, and Liz maybe can speak to this as well. Back 7 years ago when I first started dyeing my hair weird colors, catcalls dropped off dramatically. And I've always had this theory that it's like the bright colors are poisonous in nature. Like maybe people were just like, yeah, I'm not going to cross that crazy lady with the purple hair or something. Yeah, I think I became a coral snake. That's my theory. But maybe, in fact, it was just we had a cultural moment of enlightenment.
I have going back to the 80s, and I'll do double duty since Matt is on vacation, but when people started dyeing their hair weird, non-natural hair colors, I witnessed so many fights, especially with women, but also with guys. Like if they saw somebody wearing fluorescent, like Dayglo blue hair or magenta hair, people would lose their shit and just like start yelling and screaming at people. It was very fascinating.
I mean, men on the internet are still kind of mad about it. And there was a great exchange years ago, which I think we may have even talked about on this podcast before, where it was somebody specifically referenced this. I think it's called like aposematism or something like that. This phenomenon where like if you're brightly colored and appear to be poisonous, then predators will leave you alone. And it was like, yeah, bro. Like, that's the point. Like, if you look at my purple hair and want to leave me alone, like, we both won here.
So the two ways to stop catcalling are purple hair dye and pandemics.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I'm glad we've
that's actually
figured out the solution here.
You've also
here.
Just summarized 2020 for Catherine.
Catcalling has been another casualty.
Millennials ruined catcalling. Oh my God, you guys.
Long list.
All right.
Yeah.
Zoomers are ruining catcalling.
Let's move on to our final segment. And I want to find out from each of you what sex adjacent speech products you have all been consuming. Nick, let's start with you.
So I watched Bad Trip, the new Eric Andre movie, which was actually filmed. It was about to be released almost exactly a year ago in April, but was held up in the theaters because everything shut down. And Bad Trip is it's not sex adjacent. It's adjacent to Borat, where Eric Andre, who's a well-known, very funny, I think, comedian and performer who's had a bunch of shows on Comedy Central in various places. He and a friend are kind of losers in Florida. Eric Andre, it's 10 or 15 years after high school. He and his friend see a girl that Eric Andre had been in love with, and she invites him to visit her art gallery if he's ever in New York. So they steal a car from the guy's sister, who's in jail, who's played by Tiffany Haddish. It's a pink car. It's very funny. They drive up to New York, and along the way, they have interactions with people who didn't know they were part of a movie. So that's why it's like Borat. It's like a lot of pranks on people. But what's great about Bad Trip is that it is in almost all of the instances, something weird will happen, you know, and Eric Andre will become violently ill from drinking too much at a bar and is pneumatically puking, and people are trying to help him. In almost at one point, Eric Andre and his co-star, who's played by Lil Rel Howery, it's too complicated to get into the mechanics of it, but they have their penises locked together in a Chinese finger trap, and people are trying
that
to help them.
That does sound like too complicated to get
please.
Into.
Yeah,
please don't.
That's for the Patreon only super one. But no, but the point is that in every case, these are two people who are nuts. And then Tiffany Haddish, who escapes from prison and then is coming looking for her brother and Eric Andre because they stole her car, is threatening and terrorizing people who still try to help her. And they get to New York. It's very funny. It's filled with great comic set pieces. And then at the end of the movie, they show the reveals of like different scenes where the people who were pranked realized what was going on. And it is just this, it's this beautiful Valentine to America. Really, it's almost the complete inverse of the last of the second Borat movie. And it's wonderful. It's funny. It's on Netflix. And I highly recommend it. It's a weirdly upbeat, funny prank movie.
Catherine, what did you get stuck in something?
Yeah, I will say I was not like an avid Suez Canal stuck boat follower. I know there were some people who got really into it. I was like, I assume they'll get it out eventually, and I stopped paying attention. No, I want to talk about Dave Pilkey, who got a teeny bit canceled today, as Nick mentioned, or this week, as Nick mentioned earlier in the podcast. He got in trouble for a 2010 book called The Adventures of Ook and Gluk, which contains harmful stereotypes and is wrong and harmful to my Asian readers, according to Pilkey, who has withdrawn the book and will be donating any profits that he received from it. He got in trouble with the Scholastic Book Fair, which is basically the closest thing I had to church as a child. And so I am always sad to see any scandal surrounding the Scholastic Book Fair. But I have very strong feelings about Dave Pilkey because I have a 7-year-old son. And 7-year-old boys really, 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 really love Dave Pilkey. He wrote the Dogman series, the Captain Underpants series, and so many others. His books are essentially a boggle box of words that small boys like. You just throw them all together and shake it up, and it's like a superhero underpants story. Or
is this like the Calvin and Hobbes books? You know, Huey, Louie, and the Gooey Kablooey.
Yes,
Commander Coriander and her gerrymander Salamander, as
so
I recall.
It's literally that, but just done like
but for real.
Ironically, like for real. So Ook and Gluk is about
a lot of snot.
And there are always a pair of friends. They are always getting into wacky adventures. They are definitely pretty severely ADHD, and like that's just the whole deal. Ook and Gluk is about a pair of friends who travel from the caveman times to the future, where they meet a martial arts instructor who teaches them kung fu, and that is that 7-year-old boy boggle box. It just is, and you know, karate cavemen, whatever, and I get that we're having a moment of sensitivity about Asian American, about anti-Asian racism. And I guess kung fu is the problem here. I'm not exactly sure. But I just wish we could not. I mean, this is what you were asking, Liz, before. Like, why must everything be the culture war? Like, Dave Pilkey does not need to be the culture war. Like, I would love to not have to reread Dogman over and over, which I did this weekend because I do every weekend. I literally read a book by Dave Pilkey every weekend and have for years. And they're good and they're lighthearted and they have lots of progressive values embedded in them, including, you know, one of the boys grows up to be gay, and that's treated very casually, and they generally try to, you know, do some kindness amidst their hijinks. Like, they're fine, and people really should calm down. Now, this is just like the Seuss thing, where it was actually withdrawn by the author in collaboration with their own publisher, not externally canceled or something exactly. So I continue to have kind of free association vibes about the whole thing. If he wants to withdraw his book and give the money to charity, he can. But I do wish that we weren't in a situation where he had to go on full high alert and full apology mode immediately just because of some criticism about a kung fu joke.
Since I don't really have a spiel about mine, I'm just going to kind of list two different things because I couldn't decide. One is, come on, one is really short. All right, I'll start with a really short one. My dad just gave me this Dr. Pepper and cream soda zero sugar mixed, and it is the most delicious beverage I've ever had. I've been consuming it during this podcast. I feel very like vintage Nick Gillespie, like the wonders of choice, like all the different flavors of Pop-Tarts spiel.
Yeah, you're going to have a Pop-Tart with that.
I could not go through without mentioning that this is absolutely incredible. But my one
This is cutting into like cocktail territory in a way that concerns me. Right? This seems like a flavor mashup that someone should have to concoct like by hand in a little mixing glass with like
they
this person should have a beard
make a
and be wearing a
vest. I just mix like whiskey with this and it'll be delicious, Peter, and you'll hate it.
Oh man. Ohio cocktails.
I was just going to say the Hold Steady's new album, the Hold Steady is if you are a Hold Steady fan, they have kind of sucked for the past 10 years. I think they were really good in the aughts and they've had like a decade long downward turn. But their latest album that came out in February is called Open Door Policy. And it is very classic old Hold Steady without feeling like it's just like a retread. Like it feels fresh and a little bit different, but it still feels like they've recaptured sort of their old sort of, you know, post-punk or gutter punk meet like musical theater kids vibe, and it's delightful.
In their heyday, the Hold Steady was famous for consuming an entire bottle of whiskey every time they played a one-hour show during the show. And I wonder if perhaps that contributed to some of their decline. So this week, I watched the movie Nobody. It's a John Wick-style comic knockoff starring Bob Odenkirk of Better Call Saul. He kills a bunch of Russian mobsters after his family is attacked. It's short, it's mean, it's funny, it's clever, it's kind of cartoonish, it's really violent. I liked it. But what I really liked was seeing it in a movie theater, an actual movie theater, since Woo-hoo! As of this weekend, movie theaters are open with limited capacity in Washington, D.C. And man, did I miss that. And I'm looking forward to going back to movie theaters again and again and again, just as I hope you are looking forward to listening to this podcast again and again and again. That's all for this week, folks. Thank you so much for listening. Matt Welch will be back like a hurricane on Adderall or something next week to fulfill our weekly quotient of 70s baseball and Billboard top 40 references. And with that, I bid you adieu.